The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here on case 11-451, State of Ohio versus Willie Herring. For the appellant, Mr. Rivera, Justice Pfeiffer will be joining us shortly.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Ralph Rivera, and I represent the State of Ohio and the Mahoney County Prosecutor's Office. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Nearly 18 years ago, the defendant and four masked gunmen burst into the Newport Inn, leaving three dead and two critically wounded. The specific issue before this court is whether trial counsel proceeded reasonably in presenting and investigating a mitigation theory and presenting that to the jury. More specifically, this court is asked to address a very specific issue and a very specific fact pattern. That fact pattern is, in post-conviction, the mitigation specialist that was hired and retained during trial submitted an affidavit that he did not complete the investigation that he indicated to counsel that he would complete. At the post-conviction hearing, it was clear that both trial counsels testified that they had no idea or they had no information or any indication that the mitigation specialist, Mr. Hardy, failed to complete that investigation.
Counsel, let me ask you a question because I want to know what you believe to be the standard of review here. I think everybody in the room will probably agree that the mitigation testimony was woefully inadequate. However, is that our job today?
No. The standard and the question before this court is simply whether counsel acted reasonably with taking into account all of the information that they knew at that time, 1996, when they presented the mitigation theory. The issue before this court is not the adequacy of that mitigation theory.
Help me with this, because I guess what I'm reading is that somebody made a decision to bring in mom and sis, and they say he has a wonderful, loving family, and we will miss him if you execute him. And then there's another group of people who say, no, he had an awful childhood, and that's what the jury needed to hear.
The defense counsels testified that based on everything that they knew at that time, they decided to present a positive mitigation theory. They stated their theory, or that decision, was based upon the fact that they wanted to avoid the defendant's negative history and his extensive criminal record. They both testified to that, and they both testified that any type of information or any type of information that he led a life of crime would be more ammunition for this jury to impose a death verdict based on the composition of the jury.
So they were attempting to show how successful he would be if he was spared the death penalty, successful in prison, he would not be. Is that the theory, or is it he's just, this was, they certainly weren't arguing that this was an abnormality, his participation in this illegal activity.
Correct. They testified more, they painted a broad picture of he helps out around the house, he cares for his brothers and sisters, and basically spare his life. They also presented to the jury a proportionality argument. Basically, they told the jury that the defendant was the only one that faced the possibility of the death penalty, despite the fact that there were a total of five, six individuals that were ultimately responsible for this crime.
My question, though, counsel, I'm wrestling with this morning because you're describing a trial tactic, and obviously the case law is clear. We usually don't interfere with those. But how far does the scale have to go, as the Court of Appeals found, where they say there was just all of these competent witnesses in the wings, ready to testify that this guy was mentally challenged from 5 years old on?
I think the first question, which the Seventh District kind of brushed over, was the investigation. Their conclusion was more of an automatic, because Hardy failed to complete his several tasks, counsel was automatically deficient and professionally unreasonable, but that is absolutely not the standard. The standard is, and it always has been, did counsel proceed reasonably?
Counsel, the timing of the mitigation specialist, when did the defense counsel actually hire the mitigation specialist?
This mitigation specialist was hired sometime in August, and the record's clear that it was a mere weeks before the first trial was set to begin. However, there was a mistrial granted. Defense counsel testified that they were in conversations. They were trying to get other mitigation specialists. They had conversations with I believe, at least one or two. It appeared that one was either close to committing or had committed, then turned them down. So clearly they were kind of, I mean, based on the scant record that we have, they got Mr. Hardy at the last minute. However, a mistrial was granted, and at the end of the day, he had some 5 months to complete this investigation.
And Mr. Hardy, in his affidavit, said that was insufficient time?
Correct. He stated that that was insufficient time, and he had all of 5 months to complete an investigation.
Did defense counsel ask for additional time when they found this to be the case? Or did he not even tell them that his investigation was incomplete?
There was no evidence in this record that he ever told counsel that he did not have enough time. He specifically stated in his affidavit that he doesn't even recall if he told counsel. So he's not even making that allegation. Both counsel testified that he never made a statement or indicated that the investigation, that he needed more time or it wasn't complete. Both of them testified that immediately upon being notified of that fact, they would have asked for a continuance, and they believe strongly that that trial court would have granted a continuance to ensure sufficient time to complete the investigation.
So it's after the fact that the doctor writes the affidavit saying I did not have enough time.
Absolutely.
But there was nothing during the trial to put the attorneys on notice of his incomplete investigation. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And there's nothing in the record to suggest otherwise.
You're arguing to us that we should look to see whether or not counsel proceeded reasonably?
Correct.
Does that then go to a Strickland versus Washington standard as to the effective assistance of counsel?
Yes.
Does that take us to that area?
Yes. Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Your argument is that counsel were not ineffective based on the evidence that was presented at the time that the trial was being conducted.
Correct. The state's first proposition of law is. If I could summarize, despite the fact that the mitigation specialist failed to complete the investigation, counsel proceeded reasonably and providing a reasonable mitigation theory based upon everything that they knew at that time. And at that time, they decided based on, they both testified that yes, Hardy provided very little, but based on what he did provide, they proceeded with that positive mitigation evidence because they both testified that the negative information, which a lot of the information in these affidavits go towards the defendant's life of crime and his family member's life of crime.
What then is your response to the argument that had the mitigation specialist been given more time, there may have been evidence adduced that could have persuaded at least one member of the jury to vote against imposition of capital punishment?
And getting to that argument, that's obviously assuming that counsel was unreasonable.
Yes, I understand that.
I think counsel both testified that based on the jury composition, they don't think that evidence would have worked. Taking that aside, the standard review in this case when you talk about new evidence that comes to light in post-conviction is we look at all of the evidence as a whole. And if you compare it to several other cases where circuit courts, the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed this issue and found the prejudice prong to be existent. The evidence in those cases is overwhelming, and the Sixth Circuit has described it as shocking, disheartening, and utterly disturbing. For instance, the cases that the Seventh District relied upon, Wiggins, in that case, the evidence that was later found was the defendant suffered from severe poverty, abuse from alcohol, from his alcoholic and absentee mother. The children were left home alone to beg for food. There was he was raped repeatedly in foster care, and he suffered from diminished mental capacity.
Was that known at the time of the case, information that you're just talking about, in the case you're citing?
In Wiggins, no.
It was not known at the time.
That's correct.
And in this situation, after the fact, it was stated that a neuropsychologist should have been engaged in order to give a more fuller picture of his cognitive functioning, his level of intelligence, and the effects of his upbringing, correct?
That's correct.
That's after the fact.
That is after the fact.
Nobody put that on the table for the counsel to consider. Mr. Herring didn't ask for it, so that's correct, right?
That's correct.
All right, and it's even questionable on whether Mr. Hardy, the mitigation specialist, would have recommended that.
There was, counsel did employ a psychologist, a Dr.
Yes.
Darnell, who gave them a report that basically didn't find much, and he never suggested any further testing.
Precisely. He had the benefit of a medical evaluation, psychological evaluation at the time, and this was not recommended that it take place. In fact, there were contents to that report that defense counsel would not have wanted to be put before the jury, correct?
Correct. And this all goes to counsel's reasonableness at that time and why they made the decisions.
So you believe the counsel was reasonable at the time?
Absolutely.
Okay. And it was not ineffective assistance of counsel?
Correct.
And then if we apply the Strickland analysis, where do you hang your hat on the fact that there would have been a different outcome? Because that's what you have to show us, right?
Well, I mean, the defendant has to show that there would have been a different outcome.
Right.
Because the jury, there was a death verdict imposed, and the mitigation evidence here is summarized as the defendant and his family led a life of crime.
Right.
That weighed against, if you look at several of the examples that are through the case law that both parties cited, it doesn't even come close.
But counsel, in answering the chief's question, you are the appellant this morning, so you actually have to step into their shoes, do you not? And you have to plead in the negative, saying that even if all these wonderful professional people had come in, there never would have been a different outcome. Isn't that what you have to demonstrate?
Yes, yes. I said yes. That the Seventh District's decision was clearly erroneous because first and foremost, counsel's actions were reasonable based on everything that they knew at that time. And second of all, even assuming that all of these witnesses would have come in and testified to all the information that they claim and the jury finds them to be credible, that they still would have imposed a death verdict.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to that, the reasonableness of the attorneys and the incomplete report. Mr. Hardy was hired 2 weeks, you're saying, or not 2 weeks, 5 months before the actual timing of the decision?
He was hired, it's not exact, there's no evidence on the exact date, but he was hired shortly before the first trial started. They impaneled a jury, and during that impanelment of the jury, a mistrial was declared. So therefore, from that point on, till a new jury was impaneled, defendant was convicted, and the mitigation hearing actually began, 5 months had passed.
So is there any standard that says there has to be a specific length of time for a mitigation specialist to complete the work?
No, there's no specific time. It's just a reasonableness standard.
And your point is there was no reason for the attorneys to have thought that the mitigation was incomplete.
Correct, and that's based on the communication. Attorney Zena testified that there was phone conversations between either counsel and Mr. Hardy. Based on the letters, I mean, he stated in his follow-up letter that I know that there wasn't a lot of information. This was a hard case to find information. Oh, by the way, you know, could you use me again? There was nothing to suggest that the investigation was incomplete at that time.
Was he paid?
Yes.
Do you know how much?
Just under $1,700. Just to follow up that question, in his initial letter, he stated that he would need no more than $2,500.
Counsel, there's no allegation that there's an Atkins claim here, is there?
Correct.
With a deficient IQ?
There's nothing.
Okay.
If I could reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Lyon?
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices of the Ohio Supreme Court, my name is Andrea Lyon, and I'm here to argue for Willie Herring. The appellate court got it right when it reversed the trial court, holding that trial counsel was ineffective and ordering a new sentencing hearing. The court followed clearly established United States Supreme Court law when it did so, and when it held defense counsel to the same high standard that it holds the prosecution. I found it interesting when I was listening to some of your questions regarding the failure of Mr. Hardy to communicate that he had not completed his investigation. The buck stops here. That is, defense counsel is who is responsible for conducting the investigation. No more than I could blame a secretary for a late filing can I blame an investigator with whom I did not communicate very well for a failure to investigate. The defendant has a right to effective assistance of counsel, which includes, under Strickland, an effective investigation, which meant that this investigation should have been being checked on
Yes? The defense counsel consulted with Dr. Darnell, did they not?
They did.
And Dr. Darnell did an evaluation of your client?
Correct.
And he did not come up with the recommendation that there be a neuropsychologist engaged for the benefit of the mitigation hearing, correct?
Correct.
And so are you saying that the defense counsel should have on his own or her own decided that I need to get a neuropsychologist in here?
I'm saying that defense counsel should have done an adequate investigation in the first place, and had they done so, they would have discovered the trauma to this young man's head, the frontal lobe damage that occurred by just simply looking at the history. Once you see the history...
But Dr. Darnell did not engage in that kind of an analysis of the history of the person?
Apparently not.
Well, wait a minute. Apparently not, or he didn't?
He did not. He did not do... May I back up a moment, Your Honor, because
sure.
I'm not sure that I'm answering the question that you're asking me. The question that you're asking me is, should the defense counsel be responsible for understanding psychology and understanding when there's a need for a neuropsychologist? And the standards, the ABA standards that were in effect at that time actually do require that. And there was a study widely known that 97% of people on death row had head trauma that was unexplored, and so this is not something that was new or unknown.
But if a physician does an evaluation and doesn't confirm that head trauma about this patient, not all the people that were involved in a study, I'm not concerned with that, because, you know, I'd say you'd had a much better argument had Dr. Darnell never interviewed this individual. Mr. Herring, or a psychologist was not engaged here, yet he was, and professionally there was no recommendation to the defense counsel that you need to look further, and here's the reasons why.
Let me answer that. In order to do an adequate mitigation investigation, you have to get a family history first. Before you ever engage a psychologist, you need a family history, you need medical records, you need school records, you need school psychologist records, you need all of that information to give to the psychologist. It's not the psychologist's job to do that investigation, it's defense counsel's job to provide that investigation to the psychologist. That did not happen in this case. And
were those records all gathered subsequently?
Yes, and all of this could have been done. And this was not news. This kind of investigation, they had releases from Mr. Herring. This kind of investigation could have been done, should have been done, and could easily have been done. And the fact that Mr. Hardy wrote a letter saying, I didn't find much, should have been a red flag to the defense to say, wait a minute, you know, how does an 18-year-old barely 18-year-old young man end up in this kind of situation,
counsel,
absent any mitigation? Yes?
Let me put you to the same standard I put your opposing counsel
to.
What standard of review do you want us to use this morning? You say the Court of Appeals got it right.
Correct.
Correct. In order for us to make that finding, do we not have to defer to the trial strategy?
You can defer to trial strategy if there's a strategy, but there can be no strategy in the absence of information. I could have a strategy this morning to come in here and smile at you and hope that you like me, but that's not a strategy if I have not done the work to be prepared to argue this case. And the ultimate responsibility for the defense, and this is the standard nationwide, it's the United States Supreme Court standard, it's your standard, is that defense counsel must do an adequate investigation. And, you know, sort of burying your head in the sand and just saying, well, that's going to be this person's job over here, and I'll let them bring it to me, and I'm not going to monitor it, and I'm not going to make sure that they've talked adequately to the family, and I'm not going to do the kind of work that needs to be done, and if I have any doubts about this mitigation specialist,
This was a murder case, and I understand there was a mistrial called, but in reality, the expert was only hired 3 weeks before trial, wasn't he?
And
strikes me as being a short amount of time to do what's needed in a capital case.
You can't even get the paper. You can't even, I'm sorry, that's the colloquial way of saying it. You can't even get the documents that you need in that period of time. And just so that you know, the first time, according to Mr. Hardy's bill, that he ever even met the defendant, jury selection had already begun in the trial. It had already begun in the trial. And you cannot do good jury selection if you do not know what mitigation is. I wanted to point out one page of transcript to this court, if I might, and that's page 4698. And in that part of the transcript, this is after there was a ruling by the court that the defense's theory, which was proportionality, which I'm happy to discuss with you in light of jury studies if you want to hear about how little juries care about that, but that was their theory, and it was shot down by the judge. And the defense counsel said, this is our theory, we're going to be ineffective. I mean, that's what they said in court right then, because they didn't know anything else. They couldn't make a decision between should I present good, you know, mitigation and that his mother loves him and, you know, wants him to live, or bad mitigation because let's explain how he came to be the person that he is, because they didn't know how he'd become the person that he is because they had not done enough work. And to lay this off on Mr. Hardy and say, well, there's no right, and that's basically the state's brief, there's no right to effective assistance of a mitigation specialist, is like saying there's no right to the effective assistance of a secretary.
Ms. Lyon, Mr. Hardy, has he been a mitigation specialist in the past?
My understanding is that he has done a few cases.
So he had a record of being a mitigation specialist, correct?
He had been hired as a mitigation specialist.
In the past, and counsel hired someone that had previously done this work. Are you saying that the report that he submitted in and of itself should have put the counsel on notice that this was totally ineffective? The mitigation specialist was ineffective?
It should have put the counsel on notice that more work needed to be done. I've tried a lot of capital cases, Your Honor. I mean, 19 through penalty phase. And yes, I certainly rely on mitigation specialists, but ultimately it is my responsibility as counsel to make sure that the job is done.
What if your mitigation specialist isn't asking for additional information, isn't telling you that I'm not doing the job, basically?
I would question anyone who spent a total of 8.5 hours in months before the trial. I would not be comfortable that that person had done the work. That is ridiculous amount of time. I mean, there are various standards of the federal government, for example, when they appoint a mitigation specialist, presume, and I'm not suggesting that you need to have a number of hours here, I'm not asking this court to set that, but they presume a minimum of 200 hours of work.
Counsel, I want to ask a question. It's actually Justice O'Donnell's question, but before he asks, I'm going to ask it.
Okay.
And that is, what would you like us to write? It seems to me that what we'd have to write here is, this is a guide for defense counsel. This is what we expect of you when it comes to a mitigation specialist. So what are the guidelines that you would want us to impose on counsel in this situation?
Well, I would look to your own rule of professional responsibility. I believe it's 3.15. I might be remembering it wrong, and I apologize. In which the defense or any lawyer is considered to be responsible for the conduct of any member of their team.
But don't we have to impose some practical guidelines here?
Well, and the practical guidelines are in the ABA standards, which talk about the kind of investigation that needs to be done in quite a bit of detail, which have been, you know, published and accepted by the United States Supreme Court in Wiggins and Taylor. And, one of the cases that I think is instructive is Porter versus McCollum, which was a per curiam decision in 2010, where the court said, you know, unanimously, no matter whether the defendant is helpful or not helpful, the defense counsel has a duty to complete an investigation. And in Rumpia, the Supreme Court said that even doing a little bit does not obviate your duty to dig deeply. And the court has been quite clear that defense counsel must do a complete investigation. And what that is easy enough to read. You can simply go to the ABA's website and read it if you want to.
Ms. Lyon, you argue counsel's deficient performance.
Yes.
But that really only translates to the Strickland versus Washington case, where we have to find ineffective assistance of counsel.
Correct.
And Strickland is a two-part test.
Correct.
Not only the deficient performance, but a demonstration that, but for the deficient performance, the outcome would have been different. Now, where can I find evidence that, but for counsel's performance, the outcome of this determination would be different?
Well, the appellate court found that.
I don't think they found it. They said they're remanding because there might be some evidence of it. That's all they said.
Well, and that I would respectfully disagree with you regarding the standard. We don't have to show that, in fact, the outcome would be different, but that there is a substantial likelihood that the result is not reliable. The Eighth Amendment requires a level of heightened reliability in any death penalty case, and that if this decision was not sufficiently reliable, if the question, and I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question, so tell me if I've got it wrong, but if your question is, would presenting this bad mitigation have made a difference to a jury? I can tell you that yes, it would. Every case that's been reversed.
I'm suggesting that there isn't any evidence in the record that I can find that says, had this evidence been presented, it would have followed the Smith case or the Jones case, where this court has made a determination and the outcome would have gone that way and it would have been different.
Well,
I don't see that here.
We do have an affidavit from a juror that said that they would have considered it. And I think one of the things that you might want to consider in thinking about this is the fact that this jury acquitted the defendant of being a principal killer, which, you know, many studies, all the jury project tells us matters, number one. And number two, this jury was out a very long time on the question of the death penalty. That is, they did one full 8 hour and one 13 and a half hour day of deliberation, and I believe there was some conversation about some yelling and things like that were going on in the jury room as well. And the reason that matters is that at least one person was at least one person, maybe more, were not comfortable with imposing the death penalty. And had they had information in front of them that would explain, you know, why did this young man end up the way that he did? You know, where was the fork in the road? And the fork in the road was, you know, he saw his father murdered, for goodness sake. He had absolutely nothing to guide him or help him develop as a person. He was, you know, very young. We know a lot more now about what happens neurologically with people and how long it takes to become mature. And if any of you are parents besides me, you may remember how stupid you got when your son was 14 and you got smarter again when he was 20. You know, we all know that. And that if the jury had been told that this young man had no guidance, that he lived in chaos, that the only thing he saw around him was crime and criminality, that every risk factor that the Department of Justice has identified as contributing to misbehavior was present in his life, and that, you know, that the jury may very well have, those jurors that were looking for a reason not to kill him would have had that reason. And that is what is wrong here.
Well, counsel, if we agree with you in the appellate court, what happens?
The appellate court ordered a new sentencing hearing.
Correct.
And
so a new jury is going to be impaneled.
Correct.
And they will hear merely the mitigation evidence.
It's my understanding on a remand that what would happen is they would be allowed to hear evidence regarding the crime itself, because that, of course, is something
that they would... Well, they have to be brought up to speed,
yes,
of course.
Right.
All right.
But they would then hear the evidence to support the finding of an aggravating factor, and then they would consider mitigation, a complete mitigation hearing. And presumably, new counsel would know something about the mitigation and would pick a jury that was able to hear that kind of mitigation following Morgan versus Illinois and other precedent like that.
And then what are the potential, what can the jury do with this information?
What can the jury
death
do?
Death is still on the table.
Death would still be on the table, and okay, they could choose to resentence him to death. That could happen.
Okay.
As I understand it, the sentences that were available at the time of this trial were, you know, life with the possibility of parole after 30 years and life with the possibility of parole after 20 years.
Right.
I believe that's changed here, but that was, so those would be their choices.
Would there be a new mitigation investigation, in your view?
Well, the mitigation investigation that's now been done by post-conviction counsel would serve as the basis for the.
So there would be no further evidence adduced, you're saying?
No, there actually would probably be further evidence adduced, including the likely engagement of a neuropsychologist, which has yet to happen.
And in your view, you're saying 200 hours, that a mitigation specialist needs to do 200 hours of investigation on every capital case?
I'm not saying that you have to set a number like that. Please don't misunderstand me as saying that. I was just telling you that the federal standard for federal death penalty cases and the federal statute is quite similar to the Ohio statute, that with one vote is enough to stop the death penalty, that there's a presumption of reasonableness for the first 200 hours of work by a mitigation specialist. So I'm not saying that you have to say, you know, you have to put in 50 hours or you have to put in 100 hours, but I can tell you 8.5 isn't enough.
The practicalities here, we're talking about what counsel, what defense counsel in capital cases are to do to be considered effective.
Correct.
In their representation. And these were cases in which the state was paying for the attorneys, correct? And the mitigation.
That's correct.
So we're really talking, are we talking about a floor here of what is required before counsel can rely on what was done in a mitigation, by a mitigation specialist?
What I think we're talking about is the involvement of defense counsel in the development of mitigation. That doesn't mean that they have to go out to every neighborhood and talk to everyone, but you certainly, you know, as I understand it, you were the prosecutor of one of the counties here, am I correct, Justice?
Correct.
And I mean, you certainly wouldn't put a witness on the stand you hadn't interviewed. I mean, the police obviously interviewed them first, but you would interview them. And, you know, what we do know is that there was virtually no investigation.
Although counsel at the record says that one of the attorneys told Mr. Hardy, it was like, if you need anything, call us. We had normal discussions. If there's anything you're having trouble with or need, call us.
Correct.
And every time he tried to reach me, I was available. So that seems to suggest that there was an attempt to be accessible and work with the mitigation specialist. I'm having trouble with your suggestion that, you know, Hardy was not in any way, not to blame, but that it was all on the attorneys and nothing should be looked at as far as the mitigation specialist
goes. I'm not suggesting that nothing should be looked at as far as a mitigation specialist. I'm suggesting that the ultimate responsibility for the effective representation of Willie Herring to attempt to save his life, and please make no mistake, if I had gotten this file as trial counsel, take one look at it, this case was only ever about saving his life. There's no other possible thing.
What is unreasonable about the strategy of defense counsel to present Willie Herring in as positive a light to the jurors as they could, with all of the positive mitigating evidence that they could muster, and give that to the jury as a trial strategy, as opposed to saying, oh, here's a horrendous upbringing and he's done a lot of bad things and that explains his conduct. It seems to me as though, if I'm understanding the argument that Mr. Rivera presented to us, we should be looking at the reasonableness of the approach taken by defense counsel. And I guess the question is then, what is unreasonable about the approach that they've taken here?
Had a complete investigation been done and they made this decision, it would not necessarily be the decision that I might make, but had a complete investigation been done and they said, okay, we could take this path or we could take this path, we know all about the defendant's background and how he came to be who he is, and we have these two witnesses who love him, but really there isn't very much that they have to say, but we think this is better, we'd have to defer to that as a strategy. But every single case regarding adequate investigation requires that you do not defer to a decision that is made in the absence of information. It is not strategic in the absence of information.
Thank you.
Counsel, I'm sorry, you've raised a new question. I need to ask you, and I'm gonna follow Justice French's question, because obviously we're sending this case back to do something, and we're gonna see this case again. That's reality. Isn't it an argument to be made that since Ohio law has changed, and the option now is available for life without possibility of parole?
Yes.
And that sentence is more favorable to your client?
Correct.
Is your answer to the chief that is not on the table to this new jury?
I am uncertain what Ohio law is regarding the changes in sentencing. If you're asking me, were I trying this case, I would ask that option be given to the jury and waive any argument that it's
even
not,
though that option was not available during what you call the defective sentencing.
Correct. I would. I'm sorry I've gone over
time.
Okay.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds to sum up.
Thank you. One final point is that counsel would not know the total billable hours until he received the bill afterwards. So there's no indication that counsel knew that it was a mere 8.5 hours at that time. Number two, the cases which the 7th District relied upon and defense counsel relied upon are completely distinguishable because all of those cases involve counsel themselves engaging in the investigation rather than reliance upon a mitigation expert or
counsel. Let me ask you, this was back in 1996 that this occurred, correct?
Correct.
If this happened in 2013 or 14, would you not agree that there would be a tremendous amount of evidence on the fact that this 19 years old at the time, had literally seeped his brain in drugs and alcohol and from a very early age on then have all kinds of information about the effect of drugs and alcohol on a developing brain?
Certainly there would be different information available for the jury, certainly.
Okay, a lot of that information was available in 96 about the effect of drugs on a developing brain, correct?
Correct. I mean, there was, obviously we know more than now than before, but certainly.
And if this, if that lifestyle was made known to the defense counsel, and they chose not to, that lifestyle, and I mean the consumption of the drugs and the fact that, you know, the role models that he had and the fact that he, you know, lived with adults who were drug addicted, and I believe his mother was a prostitute. Was that accurate as well?
I don't know if she was a prostitute. I know she had stated that they had done drugs together.
Okay. So I guess I'm not clear. Are you saying that the defense counsel knew all of that and chose not to use it, or the defense counsel, and that was a strategy, that I'm only going to put this kid's best foot forward, or he didn't know that because of the inadequate mitigation specialist efforts?
They knew some of the information. However, both counsel were not able to testify specifically about the information, the specific information that they knew, because both of them no longer had their files. They had given their files to the public defender's office. So they knew some information. They knew, for instance, one of them testified that they knew about the some family members' criminal history, things like that. They testified they knew negative information, but specifics, there's no evidence of what specifics.
Okay, so it's a little difficult then to analyze what they knew at the time to determine the, I guess, credibility of their performance. I mean, I think, don't you agree that it would be critical to know if they knew that since preteen years, this defendant was drug involved?
There was no questions or answers regarding the drug and alcohol abuse, from what I recall from the record. I think the crux of this is the investigation. There was an investigation. It wasn't.
You would agree it was a subpar investigation, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There's no dispute there.
There was never a dispute in the trial court that Hardy actually did complete these additional tasks. It was a substandard investigation, but the focus is whether trial counsel proceeded reasonably in light of this and whether they knew about this substandard. Basically,
well, I don't think that anybody is accusing the defense counsel of sanctioning a substandard investigation and saying, oh, that doesn't matter, we're just going to wing it. I mean, basically, I don't think that that's what happened here. They may not have realized that there should be more to this story. We should be getting more information. This is just superficial. It's not helpful. It really doesn't reflect who our client is. And so that information that they had to work with should have been the red flag, and that's what, you know, the defense is saying here. It should have been the red flag that they should have asked more. They should have gotten more experts. They shouldn't have been satisfied with what they had gotten here. And whether or not they should have, or proceeding on what they had, the test is, were they ineffective, and would the outcome have been different?
Correct.
And are you saying that you don't think the outcome of this case would have been different had this young man's complete history been divulged to the jury?
I don't think so. Because counsel both testified that their theory and their whole goal was to avoid the negative information, specifically the life of crime, which encompasses both and his
family. Considering the facts of the incident, I don't think he could have been shown in a worse light. I mean, the testimony of what he did in that bar was horrendous.
And counsel testified that their theory was based on that evidence, which you are describing. They're just coming off all of this negative information. They kind of wanted to switch gears and kind of try to point him in as positive light as possible and avoid that. Additional. I mean, this was a horrendous crime, but to then present the jury with the theory of, by the way, he did this because him and his family chose to lead a life of crime.
Counsel, before you sit down, Ms. Lyon suggested if we were to affirm, and this goes back for a new hearing, new jury on sentencing, that any changes in the law, which would be the big change would be life in prison without possibility of parole. If she were handling the case, would suggest waiving off the non-application of that. That would not apply, would it? Would it?
To be honest with you, I haven't specifically looked into that.
I don't recall a case in which, if you go back for resentencing, you can be sentenced under the new law. Maybe my memory is incorrect in that
probably
regard.
Probably not, no.
Do you think it's possible for a defendant to say, I'll accept the application of a law that did not apply when I committed this crime?
It's possible, but I think it would probably muddy up the waters.
Possible with a plea agreement.
Correct. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it would have to be with a plea. It would have to be a plea agreement, through
but
a plea agreement.
Not to submit that to a jury.
Correct.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.